Welcome to The Bookshelf. I'm co-producer Nancy Roth. We're continuing with the memoir, How to Be a Sister, a love story with a twist of autism, read by the author, Eileen Garvin.
Margaret would appear to love weddings. She shows great enthusiasm whenever the topic comes up. But the truth is, Margaret loves wedding cake. To her, the entire affair, the invitations, the fancy clothes, the sacred vows, the touching family photos, the lavish banquet, and the general hullabaloo is meaningless, tiresome filler. She focuses her energies completely upon that magic moment during the reception when the lovely couple finally cuts the goddamn cake and lets everyone else have a piece. Nothing wrong with that, is there? The trouble is, everything that happens before the fork hits the plate doesn't interest her much. It's downtime, really. A tedious waiting period, most often filled, depending on her mood, with laughter or tears, and not the quiet, happy wedding kind. When we were growing up, I don't recall that Margaret made a scene at anyone's wedding reception, which isn't to claim that she didn't make any memorable fuss. It's just that by that point in the evening, she had so much competition that it's likely any outburst might have gone unnoticed. Irish Catholic receptions are really just one big scene, after all. A big drinking, fighting, dancing scene. More than once, I heard my grandmother say, on the way to the car after one of these high-energy, boozy affairs, "Oh, wasn't that lovely? And nobody fell down." Her parents owned a tavern after and during Prohibition, which is one reason she didn't drink until she was almost 70. This woman had seen it all, so she knew what she was talking about. But wedding ceremonies, even for rowdy Irish Catholics like us, are supposed to be different. The marriage rites are generally a time of quiet and reverence, a time to focus on the sacred union between two people who have chosen to try to spend, they hope, the rest of their lives together. Weddings can range widely within an acceptable scope of good taste, religious versus secular, indoor or outdoor. Tuxes and silk, as opposed to beach attire, are just a few types that come to mind. However, I can say with some certainty that most marriage ceremonies don't include a rousing, hand-clapping solo of "I've been working on the railroad" from one of the guests. I was almost a teenager before I realized that this kind of musical interlude was not common at nuptial services. No, in fact, this kind of thing was actually viewed as a disruption, the kind engineered by my sister Margaret. Margaret's particular solo went something like this. "Someone's in the kitchen with Dinah. Someone's in the kitchen, I know." And concluded with a resounding, "Ha ha ha, you be quiet, Margaret," as my sister scolded herself loudly at the end of the verse. Sometimes such an outburst would include a game of tag, with my mother being it. This game often drew withering looks from the officiating priest as my chortling sister ran up the aisle and around the altar with my silent, grim-faced mother in hot pursuit. How often I watched my big sister Margaret sprinting around the Eucharistic minister or rocking from side to side in her wide-leg stance up on the altar, clapping and singing. Sometimes she'd just start laughing during a quiet part of the service or scold herself in a parroting of our mother's voice. "Margaret, now you behave! Now you be quiet!" Her voice seemed to echo endlessly across the cool, quiet sanctuary. Or perhaps when my mother whispered in her ear, "Margaret, you have to be quiet or we have to leave." We'd hear only Margaret's side of the conversation as if she were on the phone. "No, okay, that's good behaving, Mom." I'd sink down in the pew, thankful that it was always pretty dark in Sacred Heart Catholic Church, hoping people would think it was someone else's family making all the noise. These episodes all ended the same way. My gentle mother wordlessly hauled Margaret, who was either wailing or laughing, down the aisle and to the back of the church as half of the congregation turned to watch, while the other half pretended nothing was happening. The doors at the back of the church would bang shut behind them, heads would swivel back to the priest, and the service would continue. I actually can't remember a wedding service in my childhood that Margaret did not contribute to in some very memorable way. Maybe that's because if she'd behaved herself, I wouldn't have had anything to remember. The celebrations I do recall are absolutely burned into my memory. As I write this, I can feel the frozen stare of a bride and groom, family friends, as the entire congregation turned to look at the Garvins. It was 1978. The groom's eyes were whiter than his tie. The bride craned her veil-covered head over one puffy satin and lace shoulder pad to try to locate the source of an undeniable and unbelievable ruckus from our pew. I don't remember what Margaret had done, only that it was so loud that even the priest couldn't ignore it and had paused in the middle of the ceremony to look our way. This was my chance to smile and give a little wave. Hi, Jim. Hi, Jane. Oh, good, they saw me. Now they know we're here, I said to my 8-year-old self, not realizing that most weddings were not meant to be interactive. This is how it went, through the marriages of our cousins, family friends, and second cousins. And at some point, we'd usually get to share the spotlight when Margaret performed her routine, always unique and never predictable. Suffice it to say that people never had to say, years later, "Did the Garvins come to our wedding? I just can't remember." They always remembered. Thinking back on all this as I wrote my bridal stories, it struck me that we could have used someone like Teresa, not so much as a wedding planner, but as a kind of crisis manager. Perhaps Teresa could have been our Emily Post of autism, the person to smooth out the crazy in our lives and make things seem more normal. This woman handled inclement weather, ill-behaved relatives, and emotional meltdowns without getting a hair out of place. Months after I interviewed her for my wedding feature, I read about her in the news section of our little paper when she pulled off one of the most heroic wedding rescues I've ever heard of. When a wildfire drove one wedding party from their site, she rushed over to another wedding she was managing on the same day at a different location and convinced the other bride to let the first couple come on over and share the same reception area, all this as the bride was marching down the aisle. When I read that story, I thought, man, she is tough. But when all was said and done, I still don't think Teresa would have been any match for Margaret. When my siblings and I got married, my sister's history as most memorable guest gave us some pause. I wasn't the only one asking myself, what should I do about Margaret? Over the years, the question weighed heavily on each of us as we, by turns, got engaged and planned the big day. Our oldest sister, Anne, tested the waters first, marrying her college sweetheart, Rob, when she was just 21. Being the oldest, her instincts were untested and kind of screwed up, so she asked Margaret and me to be bridesmaids, along with her best girlfriends, Bridget and Lori. Maybe if she'd been older, or if she hadn't been the first lemming over the ledge, she might have been too smart to ask either of us. I don't know which was the more foolish choice. The 16-year-old who got super drunk and threw up in the parking lot at the reception behind her boyfriend's van, me, or the 19-year-old autistic sister who threw such a fit before the ceremony even began, that our mother nearly missed the wedding, Margaret. The problem, of course, was the cake. The trouble began early one chilly afternoon a few days before Christmas in 1986. We'd all gathered at St. Aloysius Church with the groom's parents and his 5 siblings for a couple of hours of pre-wedding torture known as wedding photo time. The idea was to get the pictures out of the way early in order to enjoy an afternoon ceremony and evening reception. It was a simple misunderstanding, really. Margaret thought she would get wedding cake after the wedding photos were over. She did not understand that the pictures came first, and then we sat around in scratchy taffeta, freezing our asses off in the unheated church basement in the middle of winter, waiting for the wedding to start. Then came the 2-hour ceremony in a frigid, cavernous church. After that, we went to the reception and went through the niceties of the receiving line, heartfelt speeches, and special dances. Then came the cake. This was just too much information for my sister. I've come to believe that it's too much information for anybody, really. As this miscommunication unfolded, we were about in the middle of the grueling picture-taking process. There we were, 7 Garvins and 8 Moderellis in our new shoes and nice clothes being poked and prodded and repositioned by the grouchy photographer who was wearing way too much Old Spice. Our families barely knew each other, and here we all were, crowded shoulder to shoulder, just hours before the ceremony that would clinch the lifelong union of the oldest children. It was awkward, but just in that regular wedding way. The tension mounted to an irregular level when it became clear that Margaret was winding herself up for a supreme blowout. She made it through the pictures with a few tears here and there, asking where in the hell the cake was, and then she simply came undone, throwing herself on the floor of the church, kicking and screaming in her beautiful maroon taffeta dress that our mother had stitched by hand. "You want cake and punch! You want cake and punch! No!" She rolled around on the floor in front of everyone, banging the sturdy plastic handle of her bridesmaid's bouquet at our feet. "No! You want cake and punch! Ah!" This was pretty much what my brothers and I had been waiting for all day. We knew it was just a matter of time before Margaret lost her grip. But I will never forget the silent horror on the Moderelli kids' faces. I mean, who yells in church? Who pounds her dyed-to-match satin pumps against the marble altar steps? Who kicks and screams and throws her legs over her head so you can see the white crotch of her pantyhose? My sister, that's who. When it became clear that she was not going to calm down in the next half hour, let alone make it through the service, my mother announced that she would take Margaret home and nearly missed the wedding of her firstborn. Happily, a kind friend of Anne's stepped up and volunteered to take Margaret to her place and hang out with her until the wedding was over. Meg somehow managed to coax Margaret out of the church and into her car. The rest of us started breathing again, pulled ourselves together, and soldiered on, because that's what you do at a wedding. Anne and Rob suffered the minor awkwardness of having an extra groomsman at the altar, but I doubt anyone even remembers that. In later years, I couldn't remember if Margaret actually made it to the reception because I'd been too busy getting drunk in preparation for my big throw-up scene. So I recently asked Anne, and she confirmed that Margaret had, in fact, made it to the party. Oh, yes. Yes, she did. She had cake and punch! Mom said she had such a good time that her nylons were in shreds by the time she got home, Anne said, adding, "I have no idea what that means." By the time I got married, 12 years later, I'd had a lot of time to think about what to do about Margaret. I knew that I had to approach the situation assuming that something would probably go wrong and with great gusto. But I wanted Margaret to come, and that was just fine with Brendan, who was so overwhelmed with the complications of planning a wedding that he just said yes to everything and then left the country for 2 months. However, in an attempt to learn from history, I thought it might be useful to decrease my mother's status as a flight risk. So I suggested that one of the staff members who worked at Margaret's group home come along and be her date. That suited everybody just fine. Felicia drove Margaret to Seattle from Spokane, and the two of them shared a motel room at the same place everyone else was staying. Felicia brought my big sister to a party we had the day before we got married, and the two of them did some sightseeing on their own. They even came together to an impromptu, ladies-only breakfast the day of the wedding, and because Felicia was in charge of Margaret, I got to visit with my mother and Anne without worrying about which one of us was going to have to leave the table and deal with Margaret if she decided to chuck her French toast across the table at a cousin or a bridesmaid. During the wedding itself, I didn't hear Margaret at all. She sat quietly with her date, looking pretty in a pale yellow dress with small red flowers on it. Then again, there was quite a ruckus going on anyway, so I might not have noticed she was being noisy. First of all, Brendan and I got married on an antique ferry boat on Lake Union in Seattle, and the regular boat traffic was going by during the ceremony. We'd recruited a large yellow Labrador retriever named Honey to bear the rings, and the dog was so excited by all the people and the smells that she kind of detoured around for a while, attempting to greet everybody, and had to be coaxed back to her job. The amateur bagpipers, whom we hadn't really screened that well, seemed to have trouble getting started at the same time and wheezed along jerkily as we marched down the aisle. At one point, there was a spontaneous a cappella performance from the Balkan men's quartet from our soccer team, who showed up in their eye-catching skirts. Also, we couldn't get our Unity candle to light for several long minutes, which caused a lot of nervous laughter. When we finally did get the damn thing lit, Brendan was so relieved that he put down his still-burning taper and nearly set fire to the fancy tablecloth under the candle. Then he snatched up the taper and blew it out, extinguishing the Unity candle all over again. Our kind and exasperated minister pushed us out of the way and whipped out one of those huge plastic barbecue lighters, which she used to relight our wick. I try not to think about the symbolism of this part of the ceremony and its possible spiritual implications for our marriage. The point is that it is possible I just didn't notice any outbursts from my sister. I had reconciled myself to some kind of Margaret-sized contribution, but I didn't hear a peep. When it came time to cut the cake, however, I did notice a big adult-sized finger swipe in the frosting on the front of it, but no one else saw it, and I just moved a flower to cover it up. Our friends and family gathered around the cake table, listening to toasts, and Margaret hovered at the edge of the crowd, nervously twisting her fingers, but waiting patiently for us to get down to business. I was so proud of her at that moment, and I really wanted to acknowledge what she'd done, even if nobody else would really understand. So before we served anyone else, I took the microphone and explained with a catch in my voice that my big sister got the first piece of cake because she'd waited so quietly, so tolerantly, until we were ready to serve. Everyone clapped as Margaret grabbed the plate out of my hand, saying, "Thank you, Eileen!" But before too many hearts were warmed by this scene, she was back again, spitting out a bite of lemon poppy seed cake, setting down her plate with a clang, and demanding a piece of chocolate. Our brother Michael didn't invite Margaret to his wedding when he got married the following year, but he didn't invite children either, or dogs, or bagpipers for that matter. Michael's was a lovely, elegant ceremony on the patio of a small Italian restaurant in San Francisco. And it was just what he wanted. He did not want to stand up there facing his gorgeous bride in front of the intimate crowd and wonder when his big sister might run up and give him a big spanking. So he didn't invite her, and she didn't spank him, and everyone was the happier for it. I doubt that Margaret's life was severely diminished by not attending this wedding. Sometimes we just don't get to go. Our brother Larry got married the same year as Michael and did invite Margaret to his wedding. But for one thing, Larry got married in our hometown. For another, Larry and Heidi had met volunteering during the Washington State Special Olympics and knew many adults with disabilities. Several of the young athletes were invited to the wedding. A particularly gregarious pair of young men showed up 2 hours before the ceremony and sat in the back of the somber church on the Gonzaga University campus, the same place where Anne had been married. Every once in a while, as we bustled around getting ready, one of them would call out, "Hi, Larry," from their pew. Needless to say, Heidi and Larry were both prepared for some dynamic behavior. Margaret was there for the photos, but only for a few, and she did just fine. It was the rest of us, bridesmaids and groomsmen, who suffered through 2 hours of posing in the hot sunshine. Michael, Anne, and I each had a role in the wedding, so Anne's friend Lori, the same one who'd been Anne's bridesmaid, volunteered to sit with Margaret so that my parents could concentrate on their son's sacred union. Margaret was safely ensconced next to Lori before the rest of us Garvin Sibs marched up the aisle. Even so, we couldn't help but watch her as we stood up at the altar of the church, which was as hot in the summer as it had been cold in the winter. During a quiet moment of the ceremony, we all saw Margaret reach out quietly with her right hand to try and pinch Lori under the chin. Lori appeared not to notice and kept looking straight ahead and didn't blink an eye. I flinched in empathy. Margaret had occasionally nailed me before in the same soft spot, and it hurt like hell. Plus, you couldn't see it coming. Oh no, I thought, here we go. But then, wham! Lori caught Margaret's wrist with her hand, and wham! She anticipated the left sneaking in for the finish. She didn't even take her eyes off the altar. Margaret snickered, but not loudly. I tried very hard to look at a spot on the wall at the back of the church so that I would not lose my composure and start snorting. And I could sense Larry, Anne, and Michael doing the same. Our sister kept trying, unsuccessfully, to pinch Lori during the rest of the service, but she did not sing or laugh or make any noticeable noise that I can remember. Maybe she was having too much fun messing with Lori. Of all the wedding receptions, I think Margaret had the best time at Larry and Heidi's. I know I did. It was an enormous affair at the Spokane Country Club. I felt like I was at a football game. I passed people I hadn't seen in years, swept along in the buffet line, and shouted, "Hi, I'll meet you by the bar," only to be carried along in the current to the dance floor. It was a great party, fun and raucous with lots of people misbehaving and everyone looking gorgeous. One of the Special Olympians lost a beer drinking contest early in the evening and took off all his clothes in the men's room. Someone had to call his mom to come pick him up, but she was very cheerful about it. Another guest, a young intern from Larry's law firm, got drunk and jumped naked in the fountain later that evening. This did not go over so well. We Garvins are not as tolerant towards those who should know better, mostly because we have to give so much rope to those who don't. Looking back on this, I remember that I'd done all my misbehaving the night before, so I sipped soda water and nursed a hangover, people-watching and enjoying my family. Larry looked so handsome in his tuxedo, and so did Michael, the best man. Our parents were absolutely glamorous in their fancy clothes, although both of them later confessed that their feet were killing them, my dad with his gout and my mom not used to her sexy high heels. All I saw of Anne was her back as she dragged her jet-lagged and wailing children out to the car. My second cousin's kids held me hostage for a good 15 minutes telling me a gruesome story about a nest of coons in the attic and how their gun-toting dad had taken care of them. But here was my beautiful and hugely pregnant cousin Kathy and her husband David, my hilarious cousin Pat and his wife Karen had brought their lovely little girl, in whose face and name I saw my great-grandmother. There were babies everywhere, aunts and uncles, and my tiny, wonderful grandmother gripping her wine glass by the stem and beaming nearsightedly at everyone. It was a regular wedding reception. See, I thought, we can be normal. Margaret had on a lovely plum-colored skirt and a matching jacket. She wore black hose and black flats. One of the staff members at her group home had helped her put on makeup. She was actually smiling, somehow not put off by all the noise and the people. Lori told us later that they'd stopped for cupcakes between church and the country club in an attempt to fend off any cake-related anxiety, and I imagine that the sugar had helped improve her mood. That night, as I watched my older sister Margaret, my heart was full. It made me happy that she could sometimes blend in with the rest of us and not have everyone staring at her and making her seem like the odd one out. Although she couldn't express complicated sentiments, I imagined she liked to feel included just like the rest of us did. I felt a surge of gratitude toward my new sister-in-law for making room in her life for Margaret. Later, when the groomsmen and bridesmaids were making toasts, Margaret hustled in close so she could get right up next to the cake. All eyes were fixed on the lovely couple as their friends and siblings took turns telling funny stories and expressing their good wishes. Cameras flashed as people recorded the special moment. I'd like to believe that everyone was so intent on the words of love and encouragement pouring into the microphone that probably not very many people noticed Margaret. My dear sister, who had edged in right next to the bride and groom, was waiting tensely, eyes on the cake, with the hem of her skirt tucked into the front of her pantyhose. Michael's wife, who was standing next to me, noticed, too. "Oh, no," we said in unison. My mother was standing closest to Margaret, so we tried desperately, silently, to get her attention. Mom saw me gesturing wildly and misunderstood. Thinking I was pointing to the bride and groom, she smiled at me, her eyes shining with joyful tears. "I know," she mouthed. "Just beautiful." Chapter 4. Winging It. In conversation, as in most things, the middle road is best. Know when to listen to others, but also know when it is your turn to carry on the conversation. On conversation, Emily posts etiquette. Some of my relationships have become trapped in the amber of my memories, and comparing the present with the past can be confusing. My fiery dad, for example, somehow became a mild little white-haired person who makes polite dinner conversation with me instead of insisting everyone shut up so he can watch TV. My ever-tired mother, who ignored my decades of nagging about exercise, is now a road-biking demon with calves of steel. We are all always changing, I know. Even Margaret, who appears to stay more the same than most people I know, is moving through time and space in her own individual life, just as I am moving through mine. I was thinking about this one day, as I sat in my backyard in Oregon, watching the swallows dip and swoop over the garden. Their graceful flight paths reminded me of my childhood and the endless hours of summer sunshine, during which I had no greater responsibility than to sit on the dock and watch the birds. Of course, I was supposed to be watching my big sister, too. That much was always understood, if unspoken. Before I was conscious of being conscious, I knew enough to worry about losing track of Margaret. We siblings were all equally terrified when she wandered off on her own. Where did she go, and who was going to get in trouble for it? My Birds of Oregon book told me that the birds I'd watched as a child were the subtle-colored cliff swallow and the brighter, blue-feathered tree swallow. Arriving each spring at our lake cabin, we always found a new nest above the front door, created before we'd finished our own migration for the year, putting the boat in the water and navigating the icy spring waters of Lake Coeur d'Alene, our life jackets bunched up around our small ears. Swallow eggs incubate for only about 2 weeks, and the babies stay in the nest for about three more. Compared to our human lives, the entire childhood period of these little creatures is truncated into just a month and a half, which makes me realize I must have been watching many different bird families each summer above the front door, not just one. But at my house, it was definitely only one family, the same family. That's part of what's so difficult about being a child in a big family. Wherever you go, there your siblings are. The ill-informed, probably only children themselves, might argue that this is the magical part of being a big family, but I'll bet those people have never had to engage in a physical battle for couch space. As children, my siblings and I were afflicted by the constant and involuntary presence of one another. We crowded together around the same sticky dinner table, fought for position in front of the TV, and struggled for hard-won minutes in the lukewarm shower while someone else was banging on the bathroom door. We loved each other, but that concept was buried deep during the moments that we battled tooth and nail for the last bottle of Pop Shop Pop. By the time I'd moved to Oregon, those days were long gone, and now we had to go out of our way to get in one another's lives. As adults, my brothers and sisters and I inflicted ourselves on each other by choice. One way we did this was by forcing one another to participate in our hobbies. This is why I was willing to watch The Lord of the Rings with my older sister Anne's family ad infinitum, and why I let Anne pay for me to get a French manicure for my birthday, even though whenever I looked at my nails, I felt like a hooker. It's also the reason why Anne, who now lived a couple of hours away from me, agreed to come to my book club. I'd told her, my beautiful, conservative, army wife sister, that we would be camping, but maybe I just assumed she'd infer the rest, that anyone who would camp out in the woods for book club would necessarily be a bunch of tree-hugging liberals. If she didn't suspect, it didn't show. She was so gracious at the all-organic potluck and our ensuing discussion about the evils of the logging industry. She didn't even bat an eye when, after we'd eaten our s'mores and the kids were tucked in, someone lit up a joint. She just excused herself politely and went to bed.
You've been listening to How to Be a Sister, a love story with a twist of autism by Eileen Garvin, published in 2010 by the Experiment Publishing of New York and read by the author. You can get more information on the author and the book on Google, Eileen Garvin, G-A-R-V-I-N. The Bookshelf is a production of Spokane Public Radio. Executive producer is Vern Windham. Thanks to our two fine technical editors, Ellie Hawkett and Caitlin Webster. They're from the Lewis and Clark PICI class. I'm producer Nancy Roth.